So, now if you'd like to get yourselves comfortable, those on the outside, please come in. Those on the inside who want to go to the toilet, please don't go in here, go outside. And in a few seconds we'll give tonight's little talk, something to do with Buddhism and life and everything. Here come the lights. And this is fed over the internet, all over the world. And many people are listening in far off places, from Afghanistan, maybe, Iraq, the White House, the Brown House. Okay, so once you're all sitting down, got a seat. Very often people send me requests. So you can always do that, a certain subject you want me to talk about. Often I've talked about everything. There's over 1,000 of my talks on the internet. But today somebody sent me an email today saying, can you please talk about craving? That's a big subject. But especially because one of their friends is really wanting to travel a lot and they haven't got enough money. And so they're suffering and suffering because they want to travel and they can't. It's really stupid. Who wants to travel? If you have a holiday, just think about it. If you have to travel, you have to go to the airport and stand in line and go through all the queues and pack all your bags and take all the liquids out and then wait because your aircraft has been delayed and get a seat next to a fat person so you can't get out. And when you want to go to the toilet, it's always packed and you get food you don't like. And then when you get to the other end, you have to stand in line again, and you have to get questions about intimate details, you know, from the people who are checking you. And then when you get outside of the airport, you can't find your bags because they've been sent to another country. And then you have to go to the counter, and then you have to find a taxi. And when you find a taxi, they charge you enormously because they see you're a Westerner. And then when you get to the hotel, it's not what it said in the brochure. And you've only just started your holiday. Wants to travel. If you want to see like the Great Wall of China, come to Bodhinyana Monastery on Sunday. We've got a big wall. A wall's a wall. Come on. If you want to see Niagara Falls, go into the shower and turn on the shower. That's a falling water. If you want to see a rainforest, well, it sort of rained today. We've got a forest. Why do we always want, if you'd really want to see the Amazon rainforest, get on Google. You can actually see it, you know, on some, even 3D on your computer. Exactly. So, why do people always want to go to travel? Because they think it's going to give you something and it never gives you what you expect or what you want. I remember just seeing it, because I was invited to give some talks in New Zealand. And so I got a brochure on New Zealand, the most beautiful countryside there. And there's these mountains, you know, like the lakes, with this, like the Alps, with these beautiful placid lakes. And this wonderful scenery there. And I thought, wow, that is the sort of place a monk likes to go to. Mountains, lakes, beautiful forest. But when I went there, I couldn't stand still for 1 minute. Sand flies. For those who've been to New Zealand, you know what I'm talking about. You know, in the South Island. Sand flies everywhere. And so it was very tranquil on the pictures, but the glossy pictures in the magazine, they couldn't show you the sand flies. So sometimes when you go traveling, it's so disappointing. It's not what you expect. It's not the paradise you expected. So why do you want to do these things? So this is an example. When you want something, ask yourself, why? Why do I want these things? And what would it get me once I get there? And a lot of times, you see, it's a waste of time. All the things which I ever wanted in life were total waste of time. Until you realize it's best just to be happy where you are and rest for a little while. Yeah, it's okay to have craving and wanting in your life. Now, to how many of you, for example, we've had a lot of people come to our monastery the last week, and I was trying to figure out why. Half of them were students about to do their tertiary entrance, their year 12 exams, or university exams. We always get an influx of people coming to the monastery for some prayers this time of the year. They're desperate. And the other half were coming because there's 100 million to be won on the lottery next week. So religion does very well out of the lottery. So, what would you want 100 million for? Do you want 100 million? Yes, you do, don't you? Stupid. There was a woman, somebody sent me, they sent me these beautiful articles, no, stories which I can use in these talks. A woman in UK, about a year and a half ago, won £41 million. That's about 100 million Australian. 41 million she won on the lottery. She was living in a small apartment somewhere in London. So she managed to realize her dream and get one of these beautiful country mansions with these English gardens somewhere in Sussex somewhere. It's a beautiful mansion which she could live in. She sold it 6 months later. And in the article they showed me, it was an article in a magazine or a newspaper, and the sub-editor had put the title of this article, "Honey, I Can't Find the Kids." Because that's the reason why she sold her big mansion. She was in one room of that huge house. One kid was in another room. Another kid was in another wing of the house. And the husband, he was somewhere else. They couldn't find each other. It was so big, it separated the family. And she was smart enough to realize that even though they had this very impressive house, she had lost the connection between the people she loved the most, her husband and the kids. So what they did, they sold that mansion at a loss, bought a small apartment. It wasn't impressive to show off to their friends, but it certainly they had their togetherness again, seeing each other every day, every hour, and creating that beautiful warmth of a family. I often like quoting that story because look in our modern life here in Perth, big houses, but people have lost the ability to live together. People get married, they get divorced. Even they go out, they don't even make it to marriage. They separate. Why is that? Why is the kids can't live with each other? We've lost the skill because we live in such big houses. Your son is in his own room. Your daughter is in another room. The wife's got her quarters and you've got your quarters. You never have to meet. You don't have to get on together. So what do you want a big house for? Small house is really good. Small apartment where you're cramped together. And then you have the beautiful love. Many of you my age, do you remember what it was like growing up in a small house? Much more than we have these days. You had so much fun together. Many of you like me may have shared a room with your brothers or sisters. Yeah, we fought, but we had great fun and we really grew to love one another. Because we had to, there was no choice. And that's something we've lost. So why do you want a big house for? Downsize, never upgrade. When you downsize, number one, you have a much more loving family and you're teaching your children how to look after one another and care for one another because they have to, because they can't escape. And number two, you're saving a lot of money so you can retire early like me. How many of you are working your butts off to pay off your mortgage? Because you bought too big a house. What are you buying that for? Just to impress your friends. Look at my big house. You don't need that. You don't need a big house, you know, by the park or next to the ocean. If you want to go to the ocean, get in your car and go there. Which is, if you want a garden, just have a small apartment and go to King's Park. Other people, they mow the lawn for you, they plant the flowers, they make it very nice, you don't do a thing except enjoy. So, sometimes all the cravings we have, you ask, what do I want that for? What do you want to be rich for? I like also telling, because I, as a monk, you move through all the other circles of life, of people, from the very, very rich to the very, very poor, to people down and out, you can go and look after them, or sick in hospital, old people with no place to go, look after them, and the next day you go to some mansion to teach some rich person. And I remember going to one of these mansions, it was in Shelley, huge house, now with water, right on the waterfront. It was a Thai girl who owned that house, so she wanted a blessing ceremony, a Buddhist blessing ceremony. And this is not an exaggeration. When I arrived from monastery down at Serpentine, it took 1 hour, so the first thing I wanted to do was to go to the toilet. I said, where's the toilet? And she got a piece of paper and wrote out a map of how to get there. That's how big the house was. These days, mansions in Perth come with their own GPS. So you can find your way around. That's how big they are. And then, the killer was, I asked her, how many people live in this house? I had about 12 or 15 bedrooms. How many people live here? She said, just me. And I was a shock. And I've heard that many times before. In these big mansions, one or two people live there, that's all. And I said, why don't you invite your friends in and relations in? No way. If I ask my relations in, they will come and ask me for some of my money. Same with my friends. They've got this good investment. I'm afraid of my family and friends that they'll ask me for some of my money. And I thought, what a sad woman that was. A big house, and it was her prison. She would allow no one in. Even letting me in, a monk, she was afraid I'd ask for a donation. That's a trouble with people. What do you want? You get this big house, you get this wealth, and you have a prison for yourself with no friends. That's why in Buddhism we say middle way. Not too wealthy, not too poor. That is the best. So those of you who have just got enough, don't buy lottery ticket. You will spoil your happiness. And this was research. You can check this out. It was done in United States, in UK, even in Australia as well, a few years ago. They did realize, this is sociologists, they realize if you do earn too high a salary, it's suffering. You've got too many worries. You have to invest it. And when you invest it, you're always worried about the stock market going up, going down, or this investment company being fraudulent and cheating you, and you lose all your funds, you're always worried about it. If you've got excess money, how can you invest it? And that is always a worry for you. That's a worry which poor people don't have. They've got no money to invest, so they don't have that money, but that worry. But they have the worry of not having enough to, you know, do what they really want to do in life. You know, maybe go for a holiday overseas, or just, you know, have a nice car or nice clothes or go out at night. So if you're too poor, you're going to suffer. If you're too rich, you're going to suffer. There must be the middle best, the optimum income. Not too much, not too little. And the sociologists worked out, with some psychologists helping out, with extensive research, they found the happiest people are the ones with an income, individual income, about 50,000 Aussie a year. More than that, and you've got excess, you've got to invest it, and it's a trouble for you. Less than that, you haven't got enough to enjoy yourself. About 50, that was a couple of years ago. Inflation, say, 55 or 60,000 a year now. So any one of you earning more than 55 or significantly more than, say, $60,000 a year, you're going to be very unhappy. And out of compassion, I can help. The Buddhist society can make you more happy. And the happy box is in the two in the back there called donation box. So sometimes what do you want more for? You just get more trouble. So a lot of times the craving which we have is, when we think about it, what do we want more for? It's just going to be more problems, a bigger house, even a big car. Somebody said that they were invited to a friend who had a McLaren car. This is like sports car. You know, this is what they do in Formula One, here in Perth somewhere. And they said, come, I would go for a drive. And they went 200 kilometres an hour. You know, down, I think it was a Leech Highway or somewhere, I don't know where. They were very lucky not to get caught by the police. And you think, why do you want a big car like that for? You can't use it. You have to be so afraid, not that you'll die, but being caught by the police and this expensive car impounded and you lose all the money. Number two, if you have an expensive car like that, if you park an expensive Ferrari outside here, you know, this is not a mile, it's next to Balga. It'll be gone by the time the talk's over. But if you just have an old bomb of a car, you know, just an old Ford, you know, 10 years old, a few scratches on it, it's perfectly safe. You have nothing to worry about. That's why an old car, as long as it works, is the best. Simple, free of worry, and you don't have to pay so much insurance on it. That's why, what do you want these big cars for? So a lot of times, simplicity is the very, very best. There's a few young people here, kids, and I'm not sure if I said this last week, but I've said it a lot. Look, if you are very, very young, you know, boys want to marry beautiful girls. And the girls want to marry rich guys so they can have a good life. And that is a lot of suffering. If you marry a rich guy, or you girls, he can afford a mistress. And he probably will, knowing boys. But if he's poor, you're perfectly safe. He can't afford a mistress. So if you marry a rich boy, you're safe for the rest of your life. And the same, if you boys marry a beautiful girl, other guys will try and seduce her. And you'll always be jealous of her. But if you marry an ugly girl, again, you have nothing to worry about. So tell your kids, if they want to be happy, marry ugly girls if you're a boy, and poor boys if you're a girl, and then you'll be happy ever after. That's the Buddhist solution to happy marriages. But there's something to that. Why do we always want the beautiful girl? Why do we always want the rich guy? It's, what do we really want in a marriage anyway? Just we want someone to share our life with, someone we can trust. You know, someone who can bring us happiness. In particular, we want someone who can love us for who we are. And here we go on to another form of wanting. Wanting your partner to be different. How many of you get married wanting to change your partner? What is it they say that women get married to guys thinking they will change them and mold them into the perfect husband? And guys, they marry girls hoping they won't change, they won't get old with all the things sagging. And of course you can't do that. But really, what do you really want? You know, I talk to many people in my job, and a couple of times I've talked to youth groups. You know, young people, 14, the last time was over in Kuala Lumpur. At this big youth conference, and I was talking to the boys and the girls. I separated them out, first of all, because it's a waste of time talking religion, because what boys and girls are interested in is each other. So I talked to the boys. First of all, I said, what do you want in a girlfriend? What would you like in a girlfriend? And all the boys suddenly started paying attention. You know, this is something they don't teach in school. And this is something the boys really wanted to know. I know when I grew up, no one told me. You had to try and figure it out for yourself. You used to ask other boys, and what did they know about what girls want? So, I asked the girls, what do you like in a boy? What would make a boy really attractive? And they talked with each other, and they came to the conclusion they didn't have to be strong and macho and show off. They wanted boys they could trust. They were well-groomed, not dirty. Wanted, you know, people who would make them happy, were fun to be with. They didn't have to be strong and big. It was like trust, caring, reliable, fun to be with. That was high on the list of what these girls told me they wanted in a boyfriend. And I asked the boys, what do you want in a girl? Do they have to be drop-dead gorgeous? Well, it helps, I'm a boy, but it's not that important what the boys wanted. And they said this, we wanted someone we can trust. Someone who will care for us, someone who's fun to be with. It's amazing, it was exactly the same thing. You want someone who you can be with, trusting, caring, you can relate with, and have fun together with. They were the highest priority. And all this other stuff, if only we'd learned that earlier, we wouldn't need to waste so much money on expensive clothes. That doesn't really sort of do much for the other partner. If you see a girl with expensive clothes and you're a guy, I can't afford that. If I marry that, I'd be working my butt off all day for the rest of my life. Same with guys. If that's what you need to impress a girl, expensive stuff, it's not much of a relationship. People want to trust each other, care for each other, have a relationship of trust and caring and fun. So it's wonderful when we find out what we really want. Then a lot of this craving which we have, you know, for a pretty face and makeovers and Botox and breast implants and goodness knows what else, you don't have to do that anymore. Oh, what a relief. I feel especially as a monk, so I'm concerned with the females. After I went to Melbourne a few years ago, when the fashion was, you know, for low jeans and no high halters, with all this flesh exposed in the middle. Do you remember that time? And this was in Melbourne in the middle of winter, and I saw many of those girls with blue midriffs. It was so cold, their skin was going blue. I thought, why do you do that? Just for fashion. Just to get a boy, torturing yourself. I still don't understand how you can walk in high heels. That's torture. What do you do that for? Because you think that that's the only way you can attract. It doesn't work. I'm a monk. I know these things. People tell when I'm smart. But a lot of times we do that because we think, not just we attract others, because we think it gives us self-esteem. We think that's what we need to get attention and praise and respect from others. You don't need that. What you really need is to have this beautiful sense of respect and care. What respect and care is, as I mentioned this a little bit earlier, it's an old story, but it's the best, which shows you what wanting truly is, what craving is, and how the end of craving creates what you really wanted in the first place. It was that time when my father took me aside when I was 13. In a car, Churchfield Road, Acton, parked his car, turned around to me and said, son, wherever you go in your life, whatever you do, however you turn out, I want you to know the door of my house will always be open to you. I'll never close my house, my home to you, no matter what you do. You're my son, I love you, and that's it. Remember this, I was a 13-year-old boy. I didn't really understand much. I thought I did, but I didn't really understand much about life. But I understood enough about what was said to know it was really, really important. So I remembered that. Years later, when I was a monk in Thailand and started to understand myself, I remembered that saying of my father, and I realized what he really meant was not the door of his house, but the door of his heart. The door of his heart was open to his son, no matter what I did or how I turned out. It's what we call unconditional love. And it was the first time I received that from my father. He didn't want me to be anything different than I was. He would love me no matter. That gave me so much sense of freedom. I understood what love was, which is the opposite of craving. Craving is wanting yourself to be something you're not. Love is accepting yourself for who you are. The door of my heart is open no matter what you are, or who you are, or how you are. It's a wonderful thing when we stop that craving. When we stop trying to change our partner or change ourselves, we start to accept ourselves. That's not wanting to be different. You know, there's so much pressure on each one of you to be different, to achieve, to be successful, to be funny, whatever is the fad going around. We always have to be something we're not. You know that, how much tension that causes? That is the main reason we have stress in our societies, trying to be someone we're not. And isn't it a wonderful thing to find somebody, a partner or a friend, who accepts us for who we are, who says to us, friend, partner, son, mum, or just my best friend, look, I really love you for who you are. You don't have to be different. You're who you are, and that's it. And the door of my house, my heart, is always open to you. If anyone has ever said that to you, you're a very lucky person. At last you feel you can just be who you are, without needing to crave all these other things in life for you to be accepted and respected. You know, that's the reason why people crave the Ferrari, or the big house, or the expensive clothes, to be accepted, to be loved. And you don't need that. There's another way, it's a spiritual way. And when you accept yourself as you are, when you love someone for who they are, all the things which you thought you'd get from craving, the holidays overseas, the big house, the big car, all these many, many friends which you think you can have when you're popular and wealthy, and all the things you crave for, you find, come to you. When you stop craving, you just have love instead. How many friends would you have if you were a very compassionate, kind and loving person? Compared to that woman who with the big mansion in Shelley, who got so much wealth, but had no friends to share her life with. You'll find that instead of craving, have compassion, and all the things which craving promised you, you'll find come. There's an old saying, it's a very powerful saying, and this is essential Buddhism. You know that one of the greatest teachings, or the most central teachings of Buddhism, is called the Four Noble Truths. And all those Four Noble Truths can all be concentrated into one sentence, which you can understand very easily. When you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. When you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. And this is our problem in life. It's okay to want things, but not all the time. Stop and enjoy what you already have. When you want your partner to be different, you can't respect and appreciate what they already are. When you want yourself to be different, you can't enjoy life. When you want more, you can't rest and relax and enjoy what you already have. I found myself wanting more because I have to work very hard as a monk. and working so hard that I'd look after this place, teach retreats at Jhana Grove. And after usually spending a weekend here, we go back to monastery. I was the abbot there, work, 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 7 days a week. And I was realizing I was getting stressed out and very tired. And I realized the reason was because whenever I went back to monastery in Serpentine where I live, I'd always go back as an owner, as an abbot. All the visitors kept on telling me what a beautiful monastery it was. As an abbot, because I lived there, I saw all the things which needed to be fixed up, all the things I wanted to change and improve. And because of that, I could never appreciate my monastery where I lived. So I made a resolution after many years of working my butt off to have a Monday morning off where I'd walk around my monastery with the eyes of a visitor, not with the eyes of an owner. I would look at all the things which had been done, not all the things which need to be fixed up. I could be content with what had been achieved rather than wanting anything more. When you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. And by doing that, I really enjoyed my monastery. It was a beautiful monastery. I could see it the same as you can see it. Or, like the simile, when you have friends around to your house. When your friends come to your house, say, what a beautiful garden you have. You say, what do you mean? There's so much work to have to do in my garden tomorrow. They look at your kitchen. What a beautiful kitchen. You say, no, there's too much work to be done. The visitors appreciate the beauty of your house, but can you? No, there's always more to be done. When you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. So if you want to enjoy your own house, if you want to enjoy the place where you live, just stop wanting things to be different for a while. And then you can see your house with the eyes of a visitor who doesn't want anything, just enjoying what they already have. You might want your partner to be different. Every now and again, look at your partner like I look at them. And it's very interesting being a monk for so many years in this place. People come up to me and they're having trouble in their marriage. I look at him, he's a really good guy. What's the problem? He's a wonderful guy. You don't know him, they say. Actually, I can see things in him because I'm not the owner. He's only coming here to visit us. I can see the good in him, like people visiting a house or my monastery. You can't see all the things which need to be changed. And you look at the girl. She's a wonderful girl. I've known her for years. She's a really kind, good person. How on earth can't you live together? It is because you only see the things which need to be changed, not the beautiful things which are already there. When you want something more, you can't enjoy the things which you already have. Do you enjoy your life? Or are you still wanting something more? When you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. That is the problem of life. I told a story, an old Buddhist story, to the monks, actually in the nuns, they were doing our rains retreat, and I told this to the people on retreat at Jhana Grove. This is an old Buddhist story about a Buddhist nun who lived in a cave. I can't change this around because it has to be a Buddhist nun for part of the story. In ancient times there was a Buddhist nun living in a simple cave. She was a very peaceful person, having a wonderful life. Now, she'd have hardly anything in the cave, just a few robes, a place to sleep, that's all, a water bottle. And she'd have her alms bowl, and every morning she'd go into the nearby village for alms food. She'd always get enough for one meal, and then she'd come back and eat it, wash her bowl, she was free for the rest of the day to meditate and just have a peaceful life. But one day when she came back from her alms round, she found there was a hole in her robe. A mouse had come into that cave and had bitten a hole in her robe. So she had to patch the hole with some spare cloth. And as she was patching that robe, She remembered, this is not the first time that mouse has eaten a hole in my robe. This is about the seventh or eighth time, and I'm fed up with wasting my time patching up a patch on my robe. How can I stop this? And she thought, I'll get a cat. If I can get a cat, then that will keep the mice away. So the next time she went into the village, she asked one of her supporters, is there a spare cat in the village I could borrow or have to keep the mice out of my cave? And so they offered her a nice cat with brown fur which matched her robe. And she was very happy with the cat because it kept the mice away. But because there was now a cat there, she had to get milk from the villagers every morning to feed the cat. And so she was asking the villagers, not just for her food, but for milk for the cat. And that was always a burden, carrying a bowl full of her food and milk for the cat all the way back to her cave. And after doing that for a few days, she started thinking, well, look, if I had my own cow, then I wouldn't need to keep asking for milk. So she did a fundraising, you know, fundraising dinner, and then managed to raise enough funds to get a cow. And so she had a cow to get milk for the cat to keep the mouse away, so she didn't have to patch her robes. But you know, the cow also has to eat. So she had to go into the village twice instead of once, because she had to get grass for the cow and beg grass from the villagers. And the villagers were pretty hard to get grass and give it to the nun so she could take it back for the cow to feed the cat to keep the mouse away. So she thought, if I had my own field, then I wouldn't need to get grass from the villagers. So she did a katina ceremony. This is one of the biggest fundraising ceremonies we're having tomorrow, in a couple of days over in the nuns' monastery, to collect enough funds to buy a field for her cow to give the milk for the cat to keep the mouse away so she didn't get holes in the robe. And so they've got a nice field for the cow. But you know, it's really hard work milking the cow and closing the gate and looking after the field. And so she thought, this is just too much for me. It's taking too much time. So she thought, maybe I can ask for a boy. You know, one of the naughty boys in the village, you know, maybe 12 or 13, having a difficult time at school. Because if you do the work for the nun, it's good karma, and also it means, you know, that naughty boy would have a good influence and maybe sort of give up his naughty ways. And that's actually very common in places like Sri Lanka or Thailand. Any kid who's having trouble, send them to the monastery. The monks or the nuns will sort them out. Thank you very much. So they found a naughty kid, and they sent him to the monastery to look after the cow for the nun. Well, not the monastery, it was just a cave. But the rules for nuns, you can't have a boy staying in the same cave as a nun. You know, people start to talk, you know, this nun's a paedophile, just like, you know, the other church. I'm not saying anything. Don't sue me. So, she asked the villagers for some wood and a carpenter to build a little hut for the boy to look after the cow in the field so she can get milk for the cat to keep the mice away so she didn't have to patch her ropes. And by this time, the villagers were getting fed up with this nun. Every time she came in, she was asking for something else. And they have a simile in the old Buddhist text. When those villagers, when they saw a brown cow coming in the distance, they would run in their houses, close the doors, pull down the blinds, because they thought that might be a nun coming to ask for something. And then someone came to ask her a question about meditation. She says, I'm sorry, I've got no time. I've got to look after the cow and the boy and get the milk and make sure everything's all right. I've no time. I'll see you tomorrow. And then she realized what she was doing. She was having to build a hut for the boy to look after the cow in the field so he can get some milk to feed the cat to look after a silly mouse. So she told the villagers, take all the wood away. Stop building the hut. She sent the boy back home. She sold the field and the cow and gave it to charity. And she took the cat and gave it back to the original owner. All those things she just gave away. So she was back in her simple cave with hardly any possessions, no responsibilities or worries. And when she went to on arms round the next morning, having given away all that stuff, she came back and found the mouse had returned and had bitten a hole in her robe. And happily she sewed it up. And that's the end of the story. Do you understand that? That's not just for Buddhist nuns, it's for you as well. I'll get the washing machine, the new one. And then I'll get the washing machine to wash the clothes which I have to wear to go to work, to make money, to buy the washing machine. Isn't there something going wrong there? You see how wanting. What do you really want anyway? The last story, before I open up for questions over the internet. Again, it's okay to want a few things. I'm not saying don't want anything. But ask yourself, what do you want it for? Is it really necessary? And what are you sacrificing for all these cravings? The last story is one of my favourite ones. I wrote this in Opening the Door, but it fits in on the story. It's the story of the old Mexican fisherman. You know, there was an American who went on vacation to the Caribbean coast. And when he was just walking around by the shore, he saw a fishing boat come in to unload its morning catch. And this Mexican fisherman unloaded the catch, and this American came up to have a conversation with him. He said, "What are you doing?" "Señor," he told the American, "I've been out fishing all morning. I've got enough fish here to sell to feed my family. So now I'm going to go home and have a nice lunch. After lunch I'm going to have a sleep, a siesta. It's good for your health. You don't get stressed out if you have a siesta. Can you have a siesta or are you too busy?" "I'm going to have a siesta. And after siesta I'll be home when my kids come back from school. I'll play with them, help them with their homework. And in the evening I'm going to have dinner with my wife and maybe go to the cantina, the pub in Mexico. Having a couple of tequilas, not much, and play the guitar with my friends, life is good." And that's when the American said, "Sir, I'm a professor of business studies in a business school in the United States. I think I can help you. Don't be so lazy. You are not exploiting this wonderful resource of a fishing boat. Yeah, go home and have lunch, but go out in the afternoon. You'll catch twice as much fish. With the extra profit from twice as much fish, you'll be able to buy a much bigger boat with a crew. That way, you'll soon be able to catch about 4 or 6 times as many fish. With that extra profit, you'll be able to buy a second boat. In about 4 or 5 years, you'll probably have a whole fleet of boats. And then, with a whole fleet of boats, you can even make your own cannery, so you can process the fish. It's downstream processing to increase your profits. And then with that business, you can actually move the center of your business to Mexico City, or even better, to LA. And then because you own the whole business, you can float it on the stock market, sell shares. Because you're the CEO, you can award yourself these amazing, obscene salaries. And give yourself stock options, which means if the stock goes up, you can buy. If it doesn't, you don't need to. You can be a millionaire many times over in about 10 years. Now, I'm a professor of business studies. That's how it's done." And the Mexican fisherman listened very respectfully until the end of his presentation. The Mexican fisherman said, "But, Señor, what will I do with all those millions of dollars?" And Professor thought for a few moments. He hadn't thought the business plan out that far. So he had to think. That's all people think about, making the few millions, but then what? And the professor said, "Well, yeah, with all that few millions, you can retire. You can retire to a nice fishing village like this. Buy yourself a small boat just to go out in the morning for fun. You'll be able to have lunch with your wife every day. You'll be able to take a siesta afterwards. And you'll always be home to play with your children when they come back from school. And you'll be able to go out in the evening with no worries at all." "Señor, I do that already." That's a wonderful story, because what do you want to be rich for? People want to be rich so they can live like a poor man. I'm poor already. I'm there. I've arrived. So this talk this evening, what do you want and why do you want it? Be wise. And you find that you can be have so much happiness and contentment with who you've got, with what you have. Even with the partner you have, the house you have, the life you have. When you want something more, you just can't enjoy anything. I've known many poor people who've been so happy. I mean, many people who have got disabilities. They come to peace with those disabilities, they don't want anything more, and they're very happy people. I know people who haven't got a penny to their name, not a cent to their name, were the happiest people in the whole of Perth. One of them is standing and sitting in front of you. The rest of them live at Bodhinyana Monastery in Dhammasaya. What do you want? I know that one person who's very rich in Thailand once said to me, when I asked that question, Ajahn Brahm, I want your smile. I want your peace. I want your happiness. Exactly. This is the secret of how to get it. Thank you for listening. Okay. I know that's bad for the economy, that talk, but it's good for human happiness. Okay. Question one, Sarah from Chicago. How does mindfulness reduce craving? Because mindfulness, you're aware of your body, you're aware of your mind, it gives you feedback. In other words, you see what craving does to you. Craving makes you tense. Craving makes you set up, you've got to go and do something and get something. Craving destroys your peace and happiness. And especially if you're mindful enough to notice you're hardly ever satisfied. And mindfulness shows you that when you want something more, you're not enjoying life. Be happy where you are every now and again. Not always, because you have to work. Happy where you are, and you'll find mindfulness will tell you you're getting more relaxed and more peaceful. Victoria from Singapore. Is wanting to be out of samsara considered a type of craving? No. It is actually, yes. If you try and crave to get out of samsara, you'll never get there. In the simile I take from Oliver Twist, it's like a man trying to eat his own head. If you try and eat your own head, is it possible? To want, to end wanting? That's more wanting. If you get some idea what I mean, there was four monks with a vow of silence. One monk sneezed. The first monk said, bless you. Second monk said, you've just broken your vow of silence. The third one said, ha ha, so have you. Fourth one said, I'm glad I'm the only one here who can keep quiet. You see, every time you say something, you're breaking the vow of silence. Every time you're wanting something, you're breaking peace. You're moving in the opposite direction. It's the same with all of you who've been meditating a while. If you want to get a deeper meditation, you're going in the opposite direction. If you let go of wanting, the mind becomes still. If you want to break out of samsara, go against the stream of craving. Stop wanting. Here's an old simile from Ajahn Chah for any of you who are interested in meditating. It's a very simple simile. He would hold up his hand and wave it. He said, it's not because there's flies, so in Thailand, that's what we do here in, you know, Australia. He said, this is a leaf on a tree. The leaf moves up and down only because of the wind. When the wind stops, the leaf moves less and less and less until it becomes perfectly still. Because the nature of a leaf is to be still. It only moves because of the wind. And he explained that simile, your mind, its nature is to be still, it only moves because of wanting. If you can just remove the wanting, your mind moves less and less and less until it becomes perfectly still all by itself. It's called letting go, making peace. Kindness, the door of my heart's open no matter what happens. You don't do anything. You embrace, accept. That's why when you want, you will never be still. When you want anything, even good stuff, when you let go of wanting, you find your mind becomes perfectly still and everything you ever wanted is right there. Dear Ajahn Brahm, Katrina from Germany. It's very good spread. So Chicago, Singapore, Germany. Nothing from Afghanistan yet. Maybe next week. Dear Ajahn Brahm, a friend of mine is avoiding me for no apparent reasons. No apparent reasons they're avoiding you? Maybe it's your toothpaste, or maybe you're not washing, brushing your teeth. No. A friend of mine is avoiding me for no apparent reason. No one knows why. How can I let go of the craving of wanting an answer or an explanation from him? Please advise. Look, sometimes it's best we don't know. Why do we have to know? It's that craving to know sometimes drives us berserk. I remember, those of you who remember the previous abbot who was here, over 20 years ago, Ajahn Chakro. When I first met him, he was only about three years as a monk in Thailand. And we had a meeting in Ajahn Chah's monastery, this is Wat Bar Phong. And the master would send us to all the different monasteries in Thailand. He'd say, Brahm, you go to that monastery. Chakra, you go to another monastery. Prabhakara, you go over there. And we'd have to go. And one evening he told Ajahn Chakro, you're going to Suan Gloy, banana garden. He said, okay. He had no choice. Then he asked Ajahn Chah, when am I going to go? And then Ajahn Chah changed the subject. And the next day, Ajahn Chakro, he went and asked, when am I going to go so I can get ready? And Ajahn Chah changed the subject again. And he kept on doing this day after day. And he came and talked to me. He said, I don't know what Ajahn Chah is doing. All I ask is a simple question. I just want to know when I'm going to go. And every time he asked, when am I going? Ajahn Chah would never answer. And after about a week, Ajahn Chakro stopped asking. And the following day he sent him. That's how the teacher actually taught. This desire, you have to know, you have to know, you have to know. That's a craving. What do you want to know for? When you go, you go. Do you want to know the future? I will tell you your future. The future is uncertain. Do you want to know what the weather is going to be like on Sunday for our Katrina ceremony? I'll tell you what the weather is going to be like. It's going to be changeable. You can't go wrong like that. In other words, no one knows. Why do we have to know? It's because of fear. Fear of being out of control. Fear of what's going to happen in the future if I don't know what's going on and don't plan for it. From my own experience, many years, when I don't plan for the future, when I just let it happen, many things go wrong. When I do plan for the future, they go wrong anyway. I realize you plan, you don't plan, things are going to go wrong, whatever. So because of that, I prefer not planning. They're going to go wrong anyway. How many times have you planned this, planned that, planned something else, and it's gone wrong? So has planning really helped? No, not really. So I don't plan and just see what happens. If it goes wrong, it goes wrong. It goes right, it goes right. So what? And that way you can have a much more peaceful life. You don't need to know. So if he's avoiding you for no apparent reason, fine. One of the great answers is to say it must be karma. What do you mean by karma? I don't know, but it's a great excuse. So it's karma. He's avoiding you. Why are you sick? It's karma. Why are you having trouble in the marriage? It's karma. I don't know, but it's a great... Because people accept that, and then they leave me alone and go away. So that's one of my tricks. So why is this happening to me? It must be karma. People accept that. So it's your karma, Katrina. So this guy's avoiding you. So you don't have to find a real reason. When you want a reason for everything, it will drive you absolutely crazy. Do you remember those kids sometimes say, Ajahn Brahm, why? Why? Have you had kids like that and it drives you crazy? So you know the answer to the question why? Why not? That's the best answer to the question why. So anyway, why is he avoiding you for no apparent reason? He has to avoid somebody. So he just chooses to avoid you. It's your turn. So no one. So let go of that craving. Allow it to be in the great unknown. So much of life belongs to the great unknown. So you can put that in that basket, the great unknown basket. Why do women act like they do? It'll drive you crazy, you guys, trying to find out. So put that in the basket of the great unknown. Why the men? Why can't men be smarter? Why can't men just understand? You will never know. Put that in the basket of the great unknown. And then you have much more peace in life. No peace, no happiness. That's all you need to know. All those other things are extra. So, Katrina, must be karma. Anyway, so don't always get into the anxiety of having to know. Just leave it alone. And then you'll be much more happy. Okay, so I think that's enough for this evening. I've got to go back to Bodhinyana Monastery for still doing a retreat with Singaporeans and Malaysians. And will I be here next week? Do you really need to know? Maybe I'm here, maybe I'm not. Who knows? So have a nice night and thank you for listening.